Okay, we are now going to hear a talk on vowel phonation contrasts in San Miguel Cajonos Zapotec by Laura Tejada. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. I work on phonation and tone contrast in this language, San Miguel Cajonos Zapotec. So this language, I think it deserves to be worked on for the preservation aspect, but it also has a really important theoretical contribution to make, and that is, how do speakers produce lexical tone on non-modal vowels? Okay. So what I want to know is, what can this language teach us about the human articulatory system? And it can actually, I think, teach us a lot. So I set this up in the following way. I'll give you a brief background on the language. Then I'll explain briefly the theoretical questions that I had. I give you a brief review of phonation types. Explain my methods, which is acoustic analysis and electroglottography. And then I have some sample results so far. And then also some difficulties I had during this project. And I also have some preliminary results at this point. Okay. So this language is spoken in the state of Oaxaca, Mexico. It's right here. There's less than 1,000 speakers of this language, so I don't really know that it's endangered per se, but it's definitely undocumented and small. So there's actually about 50 Zapoteco languages spoken in Mexico, and of course no work has been done at all on the acoustic properties of this language. I did initial field work actually in Los Angeles with a family. We have, I believe, out of the 1,000 speakers of this language, almost 500 of them actually live in LA, which is nice for me because I don't have to travel. So there's a four vowel system, and there are breathy, modal, and creaky vowels. And there's also two other categories, which I won't talk about here, but they're possibly also laryngealized and checked vowels. And there's high, low, rising, and falling tones. I have some examples here. I'm not going to go over them because I don't have time. But here's a creaky vowel, something like lak, creaky vowel. This is not a click. This exclamation point represents the pressed voice. So this word would be something like la'an. Can't really produce it myself. And they also have breathy and modal vowels. Brief review of phonation type. I work on phonetics. I don't know how many of you do. These are the vocal folds, obviously, and when we produce voice sounds, we're basically opening and closing the folds in this type of pattern, okay? So changing that vibratory pattern is what gives you different vowel types, okay? So in English, I just said we only use modal voice contrastively, but in Zapoteco, most of these languages have breathy and creaky voice in addition to modal. This is actually a still photograph of a breathy vowel being produced, so you can see how far apart the vocal folds are, okay? So you get turbulent airflow through the glottis in these types of vowels. That lets a lot of air leak out. So acoustically, you get a lot of random noise at higher frequencies in these vowels. So obviously, most of the glottal cycle is open. Now look, this is a creaky vowel, but look how different. The only opening is right there at the very bottom. So during the production of these vowels, the vocal folds are held very tightly together. Okay. So acoustically, we get a periodic or unstable glottal vibration, which looks like a series of irregularly spaced pulses acoustically. So the open quotient is very small, these languages. Tone, just briefly, I want to remind everybody, I don't know if some of you work on tone languages, probably you do. That's actually just another way of saying the fundamental frequency, okay, which is the repetition rate of the vocal folds. So as I said earlier, all of the other Zapoteco languages that have been studied have tone contrast. Now the reason this is so important theoretically is because non-modal voice makes changes in pitch very difficult to perceive. And that's been shown in perception studies, and it's pretty well accepted. So what I want to know is, if this language does have both features, and I think that it does, how is that possible physically for speakers to produce that? So why did I choose these methods? personally, I think the documentation and phonetic analysis, at least in this case, go hand in hand. This language represents a puzzle for phoneticians because of what I already mentioned about non-modal vowels and pitch changes. So the acoustic analysis lets us describe the properties of the signal and through that understand how it might be produced physically by the speakers. And then electroglottography helps us model the movements of the vocal folds. So it gives us a very clear visual representation of the different voicing types. Okay, this is the electroglottograph. These are two electrodes that are worn around the neck like this, almost like a collar. And the actual electroglottograph box, you can see, is right here. Okay. So it's non-invasive, doesn't hurt. It's pretty simple to use. You just put the collar on the subject like that. The electrodes have to be on either side of the larynx, so the Adam's apple. So then a small frequency current, doesn't hurt, it's passed between the electrodes. Okay. And when we do these types of recordings, you get two outputs. The EGG is here at the bottom, and then the regular acoustic signal is at the top. So basically, it's just measuring the amount of resistance between the two electrodes. Okay, so when the vocal folds come apart, you get a lot of resistance because air doesn't conduct electricity. And then what I get from this is a waveform that helps me identify different phonation types. Okay. So I'm sure you can't see in the back. These are different phonation types here. The first one is modal voice, and you can see there's a nice regular open, close, open, close, open, close. The peak is when the vocal folds are together, your signal's transferred best at that point, and then the valley is when they're apart. This right here is creaky voice. You can see the patch, just visually, it's different than the modal. The period's about twice as long, okay? And then look at breathy voice. Not surprisingly, there's almost no contact at all, just these two little peaks right there. But most of the time, the vocal folds are apart. Okay. So the advantages, acoustic, sometimes the signal reflects things that are due to the filtering action of the vocal tract. EGG gives us a direct correspondence to the opening and closing movements of the vocal folds. Okay. Equipment is easy to transport, it's comfortable. It's something you could take into the field if you wanted to. And then also, just visually, it's very easy to recognize the different phonation types for this. Okay. So, probably can't see in the back. Can we turn the lights? Anybody, like a little bit? Just to make it easier. These are just some examples of EGG. Sorry, it doesn't show very well. But basically, here you have modal voice. And here, you probably, I don't know if you can even see in the front. But you have a very clear break between the modal and the non-modal voicing. And this one actually has a little peak, then it has a big peak, a little peak, a big peak, like this. So you can actually see the different patterning there. This one might be a little easier to see. This one's even more clear, I think. This is from a creaky eval, and you can see right here you have nice modal, regular opening, closing, and then here, look what happens. All of a sudden, little peak, big peak, little peak, big peak. Okay. You can also see it in the acoustic signal on the top, but I think it's even more clear here in the EGG signal. So this is another one that shows exactly the same pattern. You have modal voice and then the irregular creaky voice. Okay, difficulties with this. Sometimes, especially with women and children, if the vocal folds are very small, you don't get a good transfer of the signal. Also, everybody's different, human bodies are different. Sometimes if you get, like if you have a big football player type guy, a lot of muscle around the neck, doesn't work. Same thing if you get people that are a little bit chubby, doesn't transfer well. So in my study, two out of my four speakers actually had this happen. They're both women, and probably their vocal folds are just so small that it didn't work and I couldn't get data from them. So I didn't actually obtain enough data to be statistically useful, unfortunately, for my study. So, fortunately, I was able to use acoustic analyses as well. I did audio recordings using the electroglottograph, but I didn't collect EGG data, just got regular audio recordings. And I analyzed these files in PROT, and I took some different spectral measures from those recordings. They were automatically calculated at four different points in each vowel. So I'll just go over these briefly. I used H1 minus H2. That's a difference in decibels between the first and second harmonics in the Fourier spectrum. So this gives us a good estimate of the proportion of the glottal cycle when the glottis is open. It's called, thank you, the open quotient. This one, H1 minus A1, it's another measurement that gives us a good indication of F1 bandwidth, which is also related to degree of glottal opening. So both of these two measures will change depending on how far apart the vocal folds are in these valves. Okay. So the benefits, obviously recordings are easier to get, it's cheap, it's easy, you can, you have to watch background noise, I had some issues with that. But generally, even in the field, as long as it's quiet, you can do these kinds of recordings and do your acoustic analysis without any problem. You can edit the files, store them easily, digital format. And then the advantage of Prot is that you can actually write a script that will take all kinds of different measurements automatically, and then you can export them to programs like Excel or MATLAB. I've used both of them, and it's easy to do. So my results, these right here, these are the 4 points in time in each vowel, so 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the colors here show the different vowel types. Breathy, you might not be able to see well in the back, but breathy is yellow. So clearly, if you look especially at points 3 and 4, the H1 minus H2 is much larger, so you have a larger open quotient, okay, for these vowels compared to modal, which is purple. And then, surprise, surprise, look at creaky and the laryngealized. Here, red and green, they're negative, so you know they have a very small open quotient, especially compared to modal right here. So, not surprising, this is basically confirming that this language does have creaky vowels with a small glottal opening, and then breathy vowels have a large glottal opening. Statistically, the creaky and laryngealized weren't significantly different from each other, so I just combined them into one category here that I call laryngealized, which is red. So it's beautiful the way it splits up. You have modal in blue, then you have breathy in yellow, and then you have the laryngealized in red. Okay. H1 minus A1, this gave pretty much the same result but using a different measurement. So this measurement here was larger for breathy vowels, again in yellow, across all 4 time points this time, 1 through 4. Okay, so that suggests that there's a greater loss of energy in the vocal tract, which means wider glottis. Okay. Creaky and laryngealized, again, much smaller negative values here, but I think as I showed in the H1 minus H2 results, I don't think creaky and laryngealized really belong to separate categories because they weren't distinct at all points. But finally, I did a discriminant analysis, which is basically used to evaluate how well these acoustic measures could correctly predict phonation type. So essentially, I just fed the averages, the results that I got from my study, and then I had the program evaluate at 3 different time points with what percent of accuracy it could predict the phonation category. So the first point is only 50% accurate, which is not really great. By point 2 is 61, but by point 3 is 65. So I think, as I hope the EGG showed, it tells you that the phonation types are more distinct later in the vowel, so later in the second half. So this statistically confirms what was suggested by the EGG results. Okay, these vowels are more distinct later. So far for this language, my conclusions are that vowels begin with modal voice and they don't become breathy or creaky until their second half. Okay, so I think, this is my hypothesis right now, is that this allows tonal contrast to be realized during the modal portion, and then the non-modal portion, obviously, is still contrasted. But this all happens within the same vowel. Okay. So my main points are that these types of analyses give us information which would not have otherwise been available. Okay, this isn't something that you can tell by just listening to these vowels. You can't hear it turn from modal to non-modal. It's not something that we can be aware of. But it does explain maybe how speakers are achieving this sort of feat of articulation in having both features be contrastive on the same vowel. then just programs like Pratt provide a backup to field observations, and they let us do a much more detailed analysis. And then I wanted to point out that I did not start out as a documentary linguist by any stretch, but I think it's really important for science, for fields like phonetics even, to realize how important languages like this are for both aspects, because they can teach us something about how all humans are capable of articulating these types of contrasts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
First of all, well, a few things about the equipment.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, certainly. Will Ryman with SIO International. I'm wondering how much does an EGG device cost? Also, what percentage would you say of a population does it not work on? I'll start with that.
Cost, I don't know. I'm a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to ask our lab manager, I don't know. We just got it last year. I'm assuming, I would say between 800 and 1,000, but I'm not. I can get back to you on that. Population, I don't want to be mean about it, but I think that in my particular case, it was a combination of people who were small and both people it didn't work on were kind of chubby.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, like, I tested it on all the graduate students, say, and I didn't have that trouble with women. So I guess it depends physically on what your population looks like. They say to try to look for thinner and younger is sometimes easier, but then obviously that's not going to represent your whole population that you want to run tests on. And they have had it successfully work with children as well, even though they're smaller and their vocal folds are also going to be smaller. So unfortunately, I can't give you a good answer to either one of those.
Patricia Shaw from University of British Columbia. I'm interested in your results, you ended up collapsing
what
you called creaky and laryngealized.
Yes.
What would have been your criteria for differentiating them in the first place?
Phonological patterns, and then also length. Laryngealized, in my initial studies, looked quite a bit longer, which made me somewhat suspicious that they belong to a separate category. And I've also had it suggested to me that there are different types of acoustic studies you can do that might separate what we call pressed voice from creaky. But I haven't, I could improve on the numbers that I got in the studies that I did, that they were distinct. Even though my hunch is based on the phonological patterns I see in the language that they might be, just looking at it from a production perspective, I can't prove that that speakers are physically doing something different to produce them. Does that answer your question? And then I'm also suspicious too of tone. That was one of my big questions still is, I want to be absolutely certain that it's not just low tone is causing breathy voice, or glottalization, like low tone, like maybe falling tone is causing creakiness. So I think they're separate, but I'm still working on making sure that that's the case.
So in the actual acoustic waveform,
mm-hmm.
for them, you're not seeing
some
any
of them,
differences.
Some of them do look different, but not all of them. Not in all the speakers, not in all of the particular examples.
I'd be interested in
what
the
differences
are.
I'd be happy to send you some of the files if you'd like to look at them.
Hi, I'm Patricia Donegan from here. I wasn't quite clear when you suggested that speakers make both tone differences and phonation type differences. Was your conclusion at the end that the tone difference or the pitch difference appears on the first half of the vowel
yes.
and the phonation, so that that's how they are perceived?
Yeah. So that's how they're physically accomplished.
Do you have any idea where these qualities come from? Tone is intimately connected with preceding consonants,
mm-hmm.
and so is phonation type. And tone and phonation type are connected to each other in
mm-hmm.
many languages,
mm-hmm.
and I just wondered whether anyone has any knowledge of sort of the origins of these tones. Do they come from the preceding consonant,
or
the following consonant? Yeah, historically.
Ooh, that's a hard one. I know in some Zapotec languages, they don't have phonation contrast at all, only tone, which makes me suspicious. but I think it's, you know, across the language family, or the Zapoteco group, it's pretty well accepted that they have tone on, and I don't know of any restrictions concerning preceding or following consonants.
So all of the Zapotec languages have tone?
Yes.
But only some of them have phonation type differences. Are there
that's
any that have phonation type differences but not tone? Oh, no.
Not
I just answered my own question.
Yeah, not that I'm aware not that I'm aware of. The sad thing about the Zapoteco family is that Pam Munro, who's at UCLA, has, you know, I tried asking her, and, you know, I said, would you look at my data? Could you give me points? And she just kind of laughed. She giggled at me because they're so different. You know, she works in the Valley. I work on the Sierra dialects. And, I mean, they're completely different languages. They're not mutually intelligible. So it's been tough.
That doesn't mean they're not reconstructable, though.
Okay. Yeah, so I think.
Okay, well, that's something to look at, maybe.
Yeah.
What is the relationship of length? Like you've mentioned it, and position within the words. Because if I remember correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, in other Zapotec languages, it's in the final syllable that you have the maximal degrees of contrasts? Or, I mean, are you finding, let me rephrase that, are you finding the kinds of contrasts that you're measuring in all positions within a word?
Yes. I can tell you the laryngealized or the pressed vowels. My personal hunch is that it's either historically or maybe so now it's V, like glottal stop V, but that you don't get speakers actually having a full glottal stop. So that's my hypothesis as to why they're longer, because that's two more I, right? Two vowel counts basically. But in some of the other languages where I've heard data, you do get nice, beautiful glottal stops that are fully released, but in my variety, I almost never get that. I just get creakiness, I get pressed voice, things like that. So that's my hypothesis about the length. But
so could I ask a question, which is, you said that, say you have two phenomena on a single vowel, basically. And you talked about how people couldn't perceive those phenomena in the way that the technology can. So what do you think are the clues that people are picking up if the perception is so difficult?
Well, I don't think, maybe I misspoke. People can clearly perceive the pitch contrast,
mm-hmm.
and they know whether it's a breathy vowel or a modal vowel, whatever. But I'm just saying that they're not consciously aware that it, if you ask someone, they wouldn't say, oh, you know, the first half of the vowel sounds this way to me and the second half sounds different. So I'm just saying that I'm sure they're aware of both,
mm-hmm.
but we need the technology to be able to show how they're capable of producing that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have another? Go ahead.
Yeah, Will Ryman again. I got the notion, or I think you were saying you see this as something valuable for language documentation. Is this something every language documentation effort should try and utilize? Or what particular circumstances would it be good for?
Well, obviously the EGG is only useful if you have phonation contrast. I'm just saying, I don't think it's fair to the language or even the speakers to not do a thorough job in terms of the phonological phonetic contrast that exists. And I think this is a great example of this language. I actually discovered by accident. I found my speakers by coincidence, but it's very important to them that someone work on their language. They're very excited and, you know, very happy that I wanted to work with them. But the more I thought of it, I thought, well, if no one had ever bothered to work on it, we wouldn't know something really amazing about how people can produce these two types of contrast. So I mean, as a theoretical linguist, obviously, if we let things like that die out and we don't find out about them, we lose out just as much as the community that loses its language. So.
No more questions? Well, thank you very much, Ben.